Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight and what's been a busy week for the Institute with a function last night and another function tomorrow. But Colin Rubenstein, a friend of Van and myself of the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, told us that Ehud Iari was going to be in Sydney on this day, and we put him in. Anne and I have known Ehud for quite a few years, and we've caught up with him in Israel and in Australia, but this is the first occasion on which he's addressed the Sydney Institute. I'll introduce him very briefly. He's going to talk on the topic Armistice Now, an Interim Agreement for Israel and Palestine, which is based on a very significant article he's recently written. But when we come to questions and discussion, he'll take questions across a range of issues. I should introduce him very briefly. Ehud Iari is a journalist and author. He's the author of six books. He's perhaps the best-known commentator in Israel and appears on Channel 2 television in Israel, but he is also a fellow of the Institute for Near East Policy in Washington, D.C. So he travels a lot between Israel and the United States, but also elsewhere, and it's great that he comes to Australia on a regular basis. So it's terrific to have Ehud Iari here today, and we're very grateful, and let's start. Thank you.
Good evening. Yes, I'm a frequent visitor to Australia because my wife is Aussie. Good thing to have. I will try to offer an observation on the state of the play of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and briefly describe the idea for how to move forward, which was published in the previous issue of Foreign Affairs in New York, and caused some stir amongst Israelis, Arabs, and few Americans. What is the state of the status of the situation right now? First, I have to say that I always find it difficult when I'm in foreign countries, but also with Israeli audience, to explain something which is very basic about the situation. That is, the Palestinian state, 67 borders, with East Jerusalem as its capital, carries no sex appeal for the Palestinians. That's a fact. There is no enthusiasm, no craving for that. And when people wonder why, the Palestinian answer is, make sure that you understand, that we understand the distinction. They are struggling for independence. But independence is not necessarily sovereignty. They are fighting to get rid of the Israelis, to get the Israelis off their back, to end occupation, which is understandable. But it doesn't follow in their logic that the result is sovereignty and a Palestinian state, 67 borders. Let me offer to you a quote. The most important, in my opinion, Palestinian intellectual today, he was an advisor to late Chairman Yasser Arafat and is now informally advising Mr. Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority. His name is Professor Ahmed Khalidi. He lives in London and teaches in Oxford. And let me offer a quotation from Ahmed Khalidi. He is not on the fringe line of Palestinian politics. He is in the middle of the mainstream. And Ahmed Khaledi allows me to quote him, and I can refer you to the quote. He says the following. He says, the concept of Palestinian statehood is nothing but a punitive construct devised by the worst enemies of the Palestinian people, the US and Israel, in order to constrain Palestinian territorial ambitions and moral claims. End of quote, verbatim. A punitive construct. The Palestinians are basically saying to us Israelis, either it is a runaway statehood, that is a state for which they don't pay the full price in peace, or we, the Palestinians, are running away from statehood. What will you do? And the challenge to Israel, and I'm speaking as an Israeli, the challenge to Israel is that the Palestinians will keep collapsing slowly, impoverished, miserable, sometimes unfortunately bleeding, will keep collapsing into our unwilling arms. And the situation is that the concept of a two-state solution, that is, the establishment is a Palestinian of a Palestinian state, is more urgent from an Israel point of view than it is from a Palestinian point of view. And Israel has to think, and I'll be coming to that, Israel has to think how to arrest the Palestinian retreat from the concept of two-state solution. My estimate, and I've spent all my life, and I'm not a young man anymore, I spent all my life in the no man's land between Israeli and Palestinian. My estimate is, give it 2 years, if we don't have real tangible progress, the Palestinians are going to declare that the two-state solution is no longer their objective, their declared objective. And they are already toying with what I consider dangerous ideas, such ideas as parallel statehood, that is, two state structures between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, functioning in parallel without demarcating borders, each responsible for its own people. Innovative idea. You have all sorts of ideas popping up throughout the Palestinian community for different types of confederal system, which means basically to have one state with two people. It didn't work elsewhere. Not in our neighborhood. In our neighborhood it doesn't work. So it is Israel, contrary to what is very often reported, that has the interest to speed up the establishment of a Palestinian state before it becomes too late. Number two, the situation underground today is that we have the Palestinians separated between the Hamas in the Gaza Strip, they took over in June 07, and the Palestinian Authority, the Fatah movement, or what remains of it, in the West Bank. Hamas is contained by Israel. We have a tripartite, if you want, blockade of the Gaza Strip by Egypt in the south, by the Palestinian Authority, and by Israel, both at sea and etc., in spite of the relaxation of the traffic of... There was never a problem of supplies to the Gaza Strip. The problem is whether Gazans, whether Hamas, are allowed to access Israel on their way to try and capture the West Bank, yes or no. And in fact, there could have been an easy solution to the Gaza problem if Egypt, an Arab country, would be responsible to open its own border to traffic of both goods and people to and from Egypt, to and from Gaza. Egypt says no. it won't happen, and it's not happening. But in the West Bank, so Gaza is contained, and they are not really firing rockets anymore after Kestrel operation. In the West Bank, with the Palestinian Authority, which is the only potential partner for negotiations, we have the best security cooperation ever. We have reached a point which is also very rarely, if at all, reported by Western media. We have a situation in which today we have zero people on the wanted list of terrorists in the West Bank. It was never like this ever since 1967. And that's the result of a very close cooperation between the Israeli security and the Palestinian Authority security. It has allowed to reduce dramatically Israeli army, Israeli intelligence agencies' activity inside the West Bank. It allows for the Palestinian Authority, by the way, to ask Israel, the Israeli army, to help when they have trouble with organized criminal gangs in the territories and they have difficulties containing them. But the situation is a situation of unprecedented cooperation, which is producing security. 2009 was the best year in terms of the number of terrorist incidents we had. And it allows, of course, for reviving economic activity in the West Bank, the removal of many of the Israeli roadblocks which were set up in order to contain the flow of suicide bombers from the West Bank, etc. This is the situation now in the West Bank. One comment in brackets. You can read a lot in the Western media, especially in the US, about the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mr. Fayyad, with his plan to establish or create an infrastructure for Palestinian statehood by next year, by 2011. This is widely exaggerated, unfortunately. Basically, what he's been doing is creating a new patronage system through the PA bureaucracy, by an ever-expanding bureaucracy financed by the donor states. And the European Union lately has informed the Palestinian Authority that they have to come up with results if they want the pace of subsidies to continue at the present pace, which is huge. It's close to $2 billion a year for the Palestinian Authority. Gaza. In Gaza, things are happening in many ways because of the impact of the political boycott and the blockade. Things are happening in not in the open, not publicly, but a public debate is developing within the top leadership of Hamas, and it is, in my opinion, of the utmost importance. For example, one of the top leaders of Hamas recently distributed to a few people a sort of a blog, an article that he wrote. His name is Ahmed Youssef. He's nominally the Director General of the Hamas Foreign Ministry in Gaza. Previously, he was running Hamas from his offices in Virginia, United States, very close to Washington, D.C. He's a very important fellow in that movement. And his article was titled, "Do we want to become the Palestinian Taliban? Do we, Hamas, want to become the Palestinian Taliban? Or do we want to be like the AKP, Mr. Erdogan's party, which is in government in Turkey, an Islamist government?" And what's behind this question is this debate going on within Hamas, whereas some people, this Ahmed Youssef amongst them, but people more important than him too, are saying, we don't really need the military wing. the Izzeddin Qassam Brigade. We don't really need the rockets. We don't really need that type of resistance that was preached by the top leadership of Hamas in Damascus, Khaled Mashal, and the military leaders. We should, rather than becoming a Palestinian version of the Taliban, a movement controlled by its military force, imposing its own interpretation of Islam and the general society, we should imitate, they are saying, we should imitate the example of the AKP, of the governing party in Turkey. A civilian party, playing by the book generally, winning elections without the military wing, not preaching resistance, etc., etc. That's major. If Hamas is contemplating, or if people within Hamas are contemplating, whether armed struggle is the right way, that's huge. That means that the pressure exercised on Hamas is bearing fruit. And this debate should be encouraged and stimulated. Many in Hamas are saying that the takeover of the Gaza Strip back in 07 was a mistake. Certainly the Hamas leadership in the West Bank. Many of them are asking, within, behind closed doors, are asking the military commanders, why did you fire 8,000 rockets and missiles into Israel for years, only in order to stop it completely after the Israeli operation in Gaza in 08. So things could be happening there. The first point I wanted to make had to do with American policy. I believe that we are witnessing now a change in the Obama administration policy all over the Middle East, across the Middle East. But I'm speaking now about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The Chief of Staff of President Obama, Rahm Emanuel, said lately that, I'm quoting him, we have screwed up in the Middle East on the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. The President himself said something that amounted to, I went into the minefield and lost few fingers. And his latest meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister, Mr. Netanyahu, was quite different from all his previous meetings. And they have an agreement to encourage the Palestinian Authority, Mr. Abbas, to move as early as possible, probably by next month, into direct negotiations to replace the proximity talks, which are now conducted by Senator Mitchell, without much progress being made. I believe that what we are seeing is the understanding after 18 months of the top experts on the Middle East team of the President that they have to change course, change tack, and try to work in partnership with the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority in order to start getting results. Now, what results would there be contemplating? A final status deal, a completion of a peace treaty between Israel and the Palestinians, will keep proving elusive. We cannot, unfortunately, we cannot solve the issue of sovereignty over, for example, the holy places in Jerusalem. No Israeli government, left or right, can allow another sovereignty in Jerusalem. The best the Israelis offered, which I think is a logical offer, was sovereignty to God. Let's deal with management and administration. No one has sovereignty over the holy places. That's basically the Israeli position. We cannot solve, we cannot resolve the issue of the Palestinian demand that the refugees will be allowed the right of return into Israel proper. In a poll held yesterday in the West Bank and Gaza by a Palestinian pollster, Mr. Kokali, 88% of those questioned said that they would absolutely reject any deal that does not include the right of return. That's unthinkable from an Israeli point of view, to flood Israel with who knows how many Palestinians, refugees, second, third, now by now fourth generation going into Israel proper. Now, it is accepted by Mr. Abbas, and he said so explicitly in an interview he had with me about a month ago. He accepts that the solution for the Palestinian refugee problem should be within the boundaries of the Palestinian state. But I don't think he has the constituency for that. I do not believe he has the political clout to make this concession, which is indispensable. So I have a strong suspicion that the only way forward is through what I call an armistice deal. Armistice as different from ceasefire in the sense that it has a political dimension. An armistice deal between Israel and the Palestinians based on the speedy establishment of a Palestinian state and a comprehensive package of interim measures on all core issues. That is, whereas the roadmap, President Bush's roadmap of the quartet in 2005 suggested the establishment of a Palestinian state with provisional boundaries only, I think that an armistice regime should deal all core issues in a comprehensive manner. Now, what's the idea which is being debated in the Arab press, in the Israeli press, and by the American officials dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian peace process? The idea is the following. In 1949, following the War of Independence, the establishment of the State of Israel, Israel has concluded four armistice agreements with four Arab states, which amounted to a sort of a de facto acceptance, if not recognition, of Israel by its neighbors. And there were all sorts of mechanisms created, mixed armistice commissions, Egyptian officers and diplomats used to come to, and Syrians, etc., used to come to Israel to the other side. It was under UN. That was the regime established. The Palestinians were not part of the armistice regime because by that stage of the War of Independence, they had no military forces on the ground, they had no presence, no control over any territory, they were not part of the equation. The Jordanian army, the Iraqi army invaded the West Bank. The Palestinians retained no territory and didn't have, by that stage, any organized troops. What I'm suggesting is that the Palestinians be called to the table now, 62 years later, now that they have presence on the ground, now that they control territory, now that they have sort of military security forces, and have a sort of an armistice deal now. For that matter, I couldn't care less how the deal is called. They can call it armistice, they can find a different definition, interim. Everything goes, as long as it moves us forward. What would be the features of an armistice regime? Number one, the establishment of a Palestinian state right away. Israeli withdrawal from most of the West Bank. We have already withdrawn from Gaza. Israeli withdrawal from most of the West Bank, roughly all the way to the barrier, creating armistice borders, not final borders. Removal of 40 to 50,000 settlers from the heartland of the West Bank. Just to give you an idea, the latest Israeli offer to the Palestinians made by previous Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was for Israel to retain 5.9% of the West Bank territory and compensate the Palestinians through a territorial swap by annexing to the Palestinian state territories that lie now within the territory of Israel. And the principle of swap is accepted by the Palestinians. According to this offer, Israel had to remove something like 96,000 settlers from the West Bank. A major move for a tiny state. So what I'm saying at the interim stage, at the armistice stage, about 50,000. And refugees. The offer should be, following what was discussed in Camp David Summit 2000, that the refugees are told that they are not called to give up their refugee status. They are not required to give up the refugee status, but still they are offered a package, a very generous package, of compensation, resettlement, rehabilitation within the territory of the Palestinian state. Please remember, most refugees reside in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. I believe the majority would go for the package if they can retain their political status as refugees for future claim. This can go a long way towards diffusing the refugee problem, which is probably one of the most complicated one in this century-old conflict. Jerusalem. We cannot resolve, as I said before, the issue of sovereignty over the holy places and some other parts of Jerusalem. But if you go for interim, we can have the Palestinians, the Palestinian state now, the Palestinian state participate with Israel in running Jerusalem, both at the municipal level, Arab neighborhoods to be managed by the Palestinian state, and joint administration, joint management of the holy places, probably with the participation of other countries and other bodies, Christian churches, there are Christian holy places, etc. Number four, replacing the current customs union between Israel and, which is according to the Oslo Accords from 1993, we have a customs union with the Palestinian territories. We don't need it, they don't need it. Replacing the customs union with a free trade zone area, and of course issuing a Palestinian national currency, etc. And finally, security arrangements. Security arrangements based on the existing cooperation between Israel and the Israeli security and Palestinian security agencies. As long as it's working, and at this point it's working, that should be the basis. It was already discussed between Israel and the Mr. Abbas, the possibility of some presence of a US-led NATO force in the territory. Who do we conduct the negotiations with? We conduct the negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, with Mr. Abbas. What do we do about Gaza and Hamas? This is the Palestinian problem. It's for them to solve. There are no issues, outstanding issues about Gaza in terms of territory. We have removed ourselves completely from the Gaza Strip back in 05. Sharon. How the Palestinians sort out their differences, their internal strife, it's their own problem. And I've been pointing to some developments within Hamas. Who brokers the deal? Basically, the United States. My reading of the mood in Washington is that some people in the administration are beginning to think along these lines. I know for a fact that some of the Israeli leaders accept the concept, if not the details. I know that President Abbas is saying that if it is, if the interim package, the armistice, if it comes following a DOP, a declaration of principles, a vision of the how the final status deal will look like, but without the detail. For example, it will state, the DOP will state, that the Palestinian state will have a territory equal to the territory of the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem. Not necessarily the same territory. I said before, the principle of a swap is accepted by the Palestinians. So there will be a statement, but not an exact demarcation of the borderline. So if you can have a declaration of principles, and I think this is fairly easy, agreed upon between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, facilitated by the US, and then endorsed by the Security Council as a Security Council resolution, then the implementation of an interim package, as outlined before, could be presented by the Palestinians as a phased implementation of that DOP, of that vision for the future. Why it is important? It is important because it provides us with the opportunity of changing the lay of the land, the geopolitical configuration underground within a year or two. That can be done quickly. That can be done during Obama's first term. That can be done with Hamas objecting but not sabotaging the deal. For a simple reason. Hamas would not accept recognition of the State of Israel or peace with the State of Israel. That's a no-no. But the armistice does not call for a recognition of Israel or a peace treaty with Israel at the interim phase. So I humbly believe that it could work. It needs the support of the international community. It needs support from the key Arab players, mainly Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. It needs loads of goodwill from both parties, Palestinians and Israelis, but I believe it's there. And I'm convinced that if we don't do it now, in 2 years, we will see the two-state concept already fading into thin air. I'll stop here.
So, many thanks. So we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. You mentioned that President Obama was rethinking or had expressed reservations about the initial policy of the administration. Is that because there is some concern in Washington that the US lost influence with Israel because it was perceived to be too critical of Israel? Would that be the reason for that, or are there some other reasons why President Obama's rethinking his approach with respect to the Netanyahu government?
Yes. I think that it has to do with the general approach that the Obama administration was taking towards the Muslim world, whatever it means, and the states in the region. Obama was saying in Istanbul, in Cairo, in other places, he was saying that he is seeking engagement with Iran. He got a no for an answer. With Syria, he got a no for an answer. With Turkey, he got a no for an answer, both under sanctions now in the UN, and already, and if you want, we can go into that through the provocation of the flotilla. I believe that they have reached a conclusion that Iraq is much more promising prospect than they thought before, that the latest general elections in Iraq were a victory for, to put it bluntly, the good guys. The non-Islamist lists won. And if the Americans can bring them Alawi with the Iraqi list, and Nouri Maliki with the state of law list into coalition, that's a very strong barrier to prevent Iranian political, if you want, dominion or takeover, political takeover of Iraq. So you hear in Washington now people talking already about the possibility that, not in a hurry, we have to get out of Iraq, but maybe the UN will be able to have forces in Iraq, which means the Americans stay under a UN flag. I believe in... I can go into Pakistan, Afghanistan. I believe that they have reached a conclusion that the first 18 months were not a great success in terms of the Middle East. Now, as it comes to Israel, I think that the conclusion of Senator Mitchell, who is the facilitator, the mediator, the conclusion of Senator Mitchell was that you can get the Israelis to make concessions and do whatever once they feel that they are backed and maintain friendly cooperation with the United States. The tone and that Obama himself, maybe, but others too, was using with Israel proved counterproductive. The whole emphasis on construction freeze was pointless because construction takes place in those mainly in those what we call settlement blocks or neighborhoods of Jerusalem, which the Palestinians already accepted will stay part of Israel. I'll give you an example. The president insisted and there was this outcry when Vice President Biden was in Israel because there was some tender for few flats in a neighborhood in North Jerusalem, Jewish neighborhood in North Jerusalem. The Palestinians in the negotiations with the previous prime minister already accepted that this neighborhood and all others will remain part of Israel. So what does it matter if you have few more apartments built there, yes or no? So for everybody who followed the visit of Bibi or Netanyahu now in Washington, the president was very careful not to go back to the demand that there will be a complete freeze and comprehensive freeze. And if you read carefully the statements of Mr. Abbas, he does not demand a complete and comprehensive freeze. He wants a freeze in the West Bank. And that was granted by the government and will be, I believe, resumed.
Yes.
There's been an almost unprecedented level of cooperation between Israel and the Arab states. Egypt has enforced new sanctions on Gaza, and recently it was reported that Saudi Arabia would allow Israeli jets to attack Iran if need be. What do you think that this level of cooperation will have once the... Do you think this level of cooperation will remain once the Iranian threat is taken care of, be it with diplomatic or military means?
I think that one of the other reasons why the Obama consideration is having an undeclared reassessment of policy in the Middle East is because the Arabs, not just the Israelis, but mainly the Arabs, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and others, who are all saying to President Obama, we cannot live with a nuclear Iran. We, the Arabs, cannot live with a nuclear Iran. So what has happened in Washington within the past few weeks, according to my information, limited guarantee, is that the understanding or the decision of the at the top level is that containment of a nuclear Iran, which was proposed by different American analysts and strategists and government administration officials, containment of nuclear Iran is not an option, is off the table. That's major. That's a major. It doesn't amount to a decision to strike. I think we have enough time for anybody, be it Israel or the United States, to decide that the time has come to take a military move. But the United States has assured the Arabs and then Israel that the policy is not to contain a nuclear Iran. It's, as I'll just repeat myself, it's a major change of policy, which remains unannounced. So they are speaking about it, but they are speaking about it according to Chatham House rules, so I cannot tell you who is saying this.
There are reports in the press that both President Mubarak and President Abbas are suffering from cancer. How bad is it, and what impact will their passing have on the situation?
President Abbas has a mild form of prostate cancer. I'm not a doctor, but my observation is that he's in good spirits and fairly good health. He's under constant monitoring in a hospital in Amman by Jordanian doctors, and he's traveling endlessly. I think his health condition is well supervised. Mubarak is a mystery. He had gallbladder removal surgery in Heidelberg, Germany, but apparently that's not the whole story. And this is why he went now to Paris. He's sick. I can't tell you because I don't know what exactly. The bet I'm willing to place is that next year he probably is not going to run in the presidential elections, and it may very well be that we will see his son, Gamal, nicknamed Jimmy, as the candidate of the ruling National Democratic Party for president. But Egypt being the single most important Arab state, when people sniff even the remote possibility of some instability in Egypt, or then it bothers everybody in the region and outside, and our prime minister, either today or yesterday or tomorrow, is going to check for himself. Because cooperation, again, just like with the Palestinians, the cooperation between Israel and Egypt is very close now and very intimate. On all issues, first of all, on Hamas.
You've described a set of circumstances which suggest success for the establishment of perhaps a pilot, what you call armistice, in the West Bank. Is that part of the strategic thinking as a possible alternative to a full-blown armistice that would then also include Gaza? Because it seems to be a simple, easy and quick step that you could take all of this.
Well, I may have not explain fully the concept. I mean, we have to negotiate with the Palestinian Authority, not just over the West Bank, but over Gaza too. And the armistice regime includes Gaza. In Gaza, we don't have to carry out any withdrawals, etc., because we have already withdrawn back in 2005. So the deal covers Gaza Strip. Gaza Strip becomes part of the armistice. Now, we have a problem because Gaza is not controlled by what's going to be the government of the Palestinian state. That's an internal Palestinian issue, which they ultimately may or may not resolve. But I said that I think Hamas will object to the deal, but will not actively resist it. And I explained why. Because it doesn't compel them to recognize Israel or declare or make peace with Israel. So this issue of the split of the Palestinians between the Hamas government in Gaza and the PA government in Ramallah has ultimately to be resolved by the Palestinians themselves. There are endless negotiations over what they call reconciliation, which are going nowhere, mainly brokered by the Egyptians. But at one point, especially if the moderate wing of Hamas will one day have the upper hand in their own debate, then you may see some deal between the PA and Hamas. But it's not in the immediate future.
Peter Bernard started a debate a couple of months ago, and he wrote in the New York Review of Books that the Jewish American lobby had alienated much of the younger generation in the United States, the Jewish of Jewish Americans, by being very conservative and monopolizing political debate and not allowing for more liberal voices, such as can be heard in Israel, to be heard in the States. Is he correct? Is politics in the diaspora more conservative than within Israel?
I have to admit that I'm no expert on the Jewish community in the United States. I know the Jewish community, but I'm not in a position to judge whether Peter is right when he says that he speaks mainly about the younger generation. Whether he's right or not. My friends are telling me that he's wrong. But I'm not in a position to judge. In the United States, in the Jewish community in the United States, you have a plurality of organizations, and it's certainly not being monopolized by conservative right-wing bodies. What we have seen, for example, back to Obama, is that Obama was trying to encourage more left-wing Jewish organizations such as J Street or the Israel Policy Forum, invite them to the White House, give them equal status to the long-established Jewish organizations such as AIPAC, the Lobby, and the Conference of Presidents of the Major Jewish Organizations. But these bodies are not in a position to compete with an operation like AIPAC. AIPAC is that's the Jewish lobby. People tend to forget is mainly a grassroots operation with hundreds of thousands of active members and donors and contributors and people who write letters to congressmen and senators, etc. It's not a monopoly of a bunch of right-wingers that took over. As to the younger generation in America, I'm simply not in a position to comment. He may be right. I don't know.
There's a question here. There's a powerful logic behind the arguments you adduced this evening, and it would lead one to almost developing an optimistic conclusion about the future in the area. History doesn't encourage me, however, to be too optimistic in that regard. The question I'd like to ask you relates to your predictions if the inevitable logic of what you outlined were actually to take place. And one might remember, I think, Will Abba Eman, who made the comment about the Arabs never failing to miss an opportunity when there was an opportunity to miss, or words along those lines. How do you see the reaction of the Netanyahu government in his complex coalition feed into the steps that you indicated? Were they indeed to take place? Would the government survive? And if it doesn't survive, is there going to be a wider coalition? Or will he somehow crash through?
Thank you. I think that Mr. Netanyahu has already, and his defense minister, the leader of the Labour Party, Mr. Barak, have already reached an understanding with the leader of the Kadima Party, Sharon's party, Mrs. Tzipi Livni, that she will join in the government in order to make it a national unity government and reduce the power, the clout, the influence of the religious parties and the right-wing Russian-based party of the current foreign minister, Mr. Lieberman. I think the understanding is there. That is, I would put it, I think I know that the understanding is there. So if the Americans were to move towards an interim, and it certainly is not going to look exactly as I have described it here, but if the Americans accept that along the way, without dropping the ball or final status, they are going for an interim in order to have a quick result, underground, etc., Bibi Netanyahu will have a government to support him. He will have a majority, I predict, in parliament of 70, 80 members of the Knesset, of our parliament, out of 120. You can have it. You can sell to the Israelis today the idea, which was impossible a few years ago, the idea of Palestinian statehood now, peace later. You can sell it as an interim, because I think Israelis are extremely worried that the Palestinians are going to back down from the two-state solution. And apart from the settlers' lobby and few factions on the right wing, nobody's interested in it.
Now we're running out of time, so there's got to be a quick question here.
Also, does Israel or do Israelis care about winning a public relations war?
Questions: do Israelis care about winning a public relations war?
I think we are losing the war over the narrative. I think we suffer from a major problem. That is, our politicians do not see the public relations war and the question of the image of Israel as a top priority. They are too engaged, obsessed with domestic politics. I keep saying that if you offer an Israeli politician of the top level 5 minutes on the radio, on some local radio in the south, or an half an hour interview on CNN or BBC, they will go for the radio. So we are losing the war over the narrative. The Palestinians are doing it better, and that's a major cause of concern to people like me and many others. The other thing is, which maybe is not maybe not diplomatic to say, but I'm not a diplomat, never will be, so I can say it. In Israel, the ministry in charge of PR is the foreign ministry. In the Israeli foreign ministry, we do not have something like the American system, which is up or out. Either you are good enough to be promoted, or you have to retire. So our foreign ministry, the arteries of our foreign ministry, are clogged with mediocre diplomats. But they still think that wherever they you send them, they have to do the diplomatic job and not the PR campaign. And this is something that a prime minister like Netanyahu, who has the skill of PR, should address, but unfortunately he doesn't.
Which about Hezbollah, Syria, Iran? Who's got a quick answer?
Yeah, the quick answer is Hezbollah is acquiring weapons, but militarily they are completely under Iranian control. So the border is quiet, and I believe the Iranian instruction to Hezbollah is not to trigger any provocation, not to get involved in any second round with Israel, unless it's the interest of Iran, which means in case Iran is attacked or the nuclear installations are attacked. Syria has always been very careful not to get involved in a in another military clash with Israel. They are amassing long-range heavy missiles, over 2,000 of them. It's a huge number, over 2,000 of them. But the border between Israel and Syria, historically, is the most quiet border of all the fronts around Israel, and I believe it will continue. I believe that the Israeli government, just to conclude, has made quietly the offer to the Syrians to have an interim on the Golan too. To have an interim agreement on the Golan Heights too, and that the Syrian answer, as far as I understand, is negative.
We have a very quick question
here. The Amnesty Society is very attractive, but has at its core this idea that the refugees will not exactly give up their claim, but defer it in exchange for, put shorthand, a bag of money. It's not entirely obvious that they will accept, but I guess I want to ask you to explore what more can be done to persuade them, or in fact, what if we get beyond your 2-3 year two-state solution deadline?
Kind of brief answer about the refugees.
Yeah, in Camp David 2000 with President Clinton, the idea was for an international treasure fund of $100 billion for the refugees. So for the interim stage, you need something which is about a quarter or fifth of it, $20-25 billion to be on the offer for refugees to take. I believe a huge number, I believe out of my contact with many, not with millions, that many of the refugees will choose to take it because they don't believe that the final status will bring them a better deal, and certainly they know that it will not bring them get them back to Israel if any of them want is dreaming about it. So I think there is a great chance that a lot of refugees will come forward for the package, and thereby you diffuse one of the major, major problems of the peace process between us and the Palestinians.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Thanks to Colin Rubinson and Ajak for making this possible tonight. I'll be very brief. I commence by saying that Ehud Yari was Israel's leading commentator, and we can see why tonight, and what has been an informative but also very thought-provoking address. So
It was great to have you here. We'd love to have you back again. I know you're a constant visitor to Australia, as you mentioned. But for tonight, many thanks for a great address. Well done. Thank you. Thank you, folks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.